two sessions in this session, sorry, two papers in this session. And what we're going to do is Dharma's going to go first. We're going to have some questions, and then Mike and Annette are going to go second. Okay. Then we'll have questions after that. Is that okay with everybody? Is everybody absolutely delirious? Are you happy with that?
Yes.
So thank you very much. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Dharma Musulnyan, as you've already heard, and I come from the University of Botswana. I'm going to be talking to you on. I worked on a paper that's entitled From Stone Age Learning to Cyber Age Knowledge. And what actually happened is, as I've been going through a lot of readings and the literature that's available in the libraries, I got informed that there was a lot of information that was there that was passed from generation to generation, even before colonialism in Africa. And of course, this generated a lot of interest in me to just get to interrogate these documents and come up with some evidence with which I can actually verify that there was a lot of activities that were conducted in various societies in Africa before there was some injection of the exotic concepts that came from the West. And of course, that led me to the conclusion that Africa had its own knowledge systems before it was colonized. And of course, these knowledge systems allow the transfer of knowledge from generation to generation. So there has, I then feel strongly that there was some a kind of learning that was being conducted as this knowledge was being packaged and passed on from generation to generation. And essentially, it means the posterity enjoyed the knowledge that was well packaged through conducting activities that could be termed to be strategies that were employed in teaching or in giving knowledge. Of course, the family and the traditional schools are institutions that conducted a lot of teaching that provided the necessary instructions for this knowledge to be absorbed by those who came to join in societies that already existed through birth and through marriage, because it was absorbed by me as well. And that meant that people from other tribes came to join in other tribes. And of course, as a result of that, they had to learn cultures that already existed and prevailed within African societies. So I deliberately took some certain areas or fields that I feel do have a lot of sufficient information to inform this discussion. And the first one is agriculture, both pastoral and arable. And my strong conviction is that in this sector, there was a lot of teaching, a lot of indigenous knowledge systems that existed. And of course, a lot of activities, the techniques and the strategies that were being employed in the African continent before the coming of westernization, or before the coming in of the West, or before Africa got colonized. And of course, in this sector, there was agriculture. It went on, and of course, animals were being looked after. And of course, there were certain plants that were being used, indigenous plants, that were being used that do have some medicinal properties to cure animals, and also there were ways that were being employed to produce crops for food. And of course, primitive as they were, they managed to see their societies in the African continent until they were found or discovered, as some people like to put it, by the West. And the home economic sector, or that field also, had a lot of activities or had a lot of knowledge that was being passed around. Of course, there was taking care of the home, and through the traditional schools, this information or the knowledge was packaged, and people were being taught how to take care of the home, the raising of children, how they should inculcate certain strong and important values on how the children should conduct themselves. There was also in the area of geography a lot of passing around of information. People studied the rivers, the impact that they had on the environment, and of course that is why there were some certain strategies that were being employed to make sure that the resources that were very important to the societies at the time did not get dissipated or did not get to deteriorate. And of course, through the totems, for instance, just to exemplify, that was a conservation strategy, because if there was a totem, that animal would be killed in a given society. And that would then mean that particular animal or plant would not get extinct because it was not to be killed or eliminated. And of course, and there were also, in the area of science, the use of plants. And of course, there were a lot of experiments that were getting conducted in the primitive ways, if you like, because there were no laboratories. But of course, for people to get to establish that certain plants had medicinal properties, there must have been some kind of experiments that were being conducted. Agronomy, for instance, the area of agronomy, not in a sophisticated manner as it is now, but there was a ring of stars by the elderly from which they made conclusions on how the future climate conditions would be or how the weather would be. So there were people who were experts in this area, and of course they held this expertise dear, and they were passed on from generation to generation. In the area of zoology, for instance, the learning of the behavior of wild animals, of course, it led to domestication of certain animals that were found to be more responsive, that conducted themselves very well according to the prescribed manner that the societies at the time did prescribe. The dogs were tamed, or the dogs were domesticated for hunting. And of course, in the environmental education, the use of totems, as I've already mentioned, we also had our own midwives, traditional midwives, who were trained to enable them to deliver babies in societies. That was before the coming or the infiltration of Western medicine and Western systems and concepts. Also in the area of communication, the use of language, there were languages in Africa even before the coming in of colonizers. But there was ways and of course channels through which communication was conducted. And of course the use of languages for transmission of information between societies and also within societies was there. In the religious sphere, there were certain beliefs that were held very dear. And of course, there were people who had those supernatural powers, if you like, who acted as intermediaries between the living and the dead. Some kind of well-informed religion, just as there are people, of course, certain societies that believe in reincarnation. There was also the belief that there was some connection between the dead and the ancestors, the living and the ancestors. And of course, there were people who had this powers to communicate or to keep the link, or who acted as intermediaries between these divorced living connected forces. Or the area of art, there was music. You know, in the traditional schools, people are taught music. There was poetry as well. People were talented, and also there was inculcation of these values, and also the activities that kept knowledge alive, that was passed from generation to generation. The painting of rocks, of course, there is some scientific proof, of course, in the use of sophisticated methods that does verify that there were, for instance, if you look at some archaeologists, they are able to unearth certain artifacts which, through radiocarbon dating, they are able to establish that there were paintings that went, or there were the making of tools that went on in Africa before colonialism. Metallurgy, the making of iron tools such as spears for tribal wars, because there were some tribal conflicts in the past, even becoming before Africa was colonized. And of course, there were tools that were being made by Africans that enabled societies in Africa to cultivate or to produce food. And my strong conviction is that I think if it wasn't because of the interference that came about, Africa would have been able to maybe modernized and it would have advanced and made more sophisticated ways, and also the tools would have, that would be there at the time, now, for instance, would be more sophisticated, because there would have been a lot of trials, there would have been a lot of experiments that would have been getting conducted, and of course there would have been some modification as well, which should have made the tools to be more good looking, and even more, which would have increased the production of food. During colonialism, there was infiltration of foreign religions. Of course, the missionaries came about, they got to the continent, and of course they introduced Christianity, and also there was the introduction of exotic concepts. And of course it meant that a lot of this information that I feel strongly was important for the African continent, which also was relevant and germane in so many ways because it was generated from the continent, got lost. When the religions, some new religions were coming in and new concepts were being brought to the continent, it then resulted in a lot of information getting lost. Also, the strategies that were being employed to pass information from generation to generation, knowledge from generation to generation, got lost. Okay, so in South Africa, for instance, just to give that as an example, the mining sector got very strong, and because of those activities, new skills came in, and of course it meant that they in a way destroyed or eroded the skills that were already there that would have otherwise have been advanced through time. Introduction of new economic and political systems. I think and I feel strongly that Africa had its own way, its own political systems even before, because we had our chiefs and there was a way of conducting affairs in a unique way in the continent, in different tribal settings. And of course the coming in of the political system as well as the economic system meant that the primitive or the outdated way at the time had to give way to this new or infiltrating culture that came in, as well as the new economic system, where then there was the monetary factor came into play, which was not there before, because there was a barter system. And of course, I think there were a lot of calculations that went on to determine the value of a certain commodity. And of course, that was done in a way that wasn't borrowed from the West before. The training of Africans in new roles that were imposed by colonizers also came about. And of course, the introduction of exotic crops and animals also came. And then there was introduction of modern schools, the curricula. That was there was that kind of obtrusion, because the curricula that meant it was determined by the colonizers. And of course, that resulted in the death of the traditional schools. And the use of Western tools and clothes meant that the old systems had to give way. And of course, that is that which happened in that epoch. And of course, after colonialism, it's now westernization. We have lost our culture as Africans, and there's Eurocentrism and Americocentrism, meaning everything has to comply with certain set standards that are set by the West. And there's a lot of consumption of European and American goods and services. And of course, there's democratization of the African countries. That, of course, means that the political system has changed. And of course, we then have a system that is dictated to us by outsiders. This colonialism, which then means we have just got a colonial village, and globalization, I mean, and globalism. And of course, this means that there is universalization of knowledge. So what is most important is that which is coming from the West. And I don't think we will be able in any way to retrieve that which is lost. And of course, there is no how that can be salvaged. But of course, I think it's essential that we mention that we did have something that was important to the continent. There's also Occidentalism. That is, there's a lot of, now there is some resistance. And I think there's also some resistance towards imperialist education. So there's re-emphasis, not getting to have the nostalgia. And of course, as a result, we are trying to find out to dig and maybe get that which we can salvage, that can be identified as indigenous knowledge. This now a new dimension which does pronounce that there's infiltration of the oriental knowledge. So it's no longer only the West and in North America, but also there is a lot of influence coming from the Oriental or from countries in Asia. And of course, there's learning, and that's the case in our university or any other institutions as well. There's the learning of Mandarin, and of course, it then means this is going to foster a process where it would even be more difficult for us to get to find out what that which we have. This modernization of traditional schools, even those communities or tribes or ethnic groups that are trying to revive the traditional schools, they are being modernized. And of course, I don't think we will have a gift of getting them to pass on knowledge that was being passed by those that existed a long time ago. I'll put my case to rest at that point. Thank you very much.
That's largely an oral tradition, I presume, is that right?
Yes, yes.
There's an oral, plus the paintings and so on. So is that now being lost?
Yeah, well, it got lost, and it is important, of course, to maybe dig and find out what really happened. There are some methods and approaches that I think can still be employed to get the little that is left. Of course, that's why I did mention that in the archaeological sector, for instance, we are able to get some artifacts, and there is information that does point out to the fact that they've been there for a long time. And of course, piecing that information together, I think, will be important.
I've got a question really about the after colonial period.
Yeah.
What do you think about revisiting the Merry Africa of the before colonial period? I mean, what sort of inroads, I'm thinking of Nyerere, African socialism. Surely that was an attempt to try and regain and revalue traditional education. Education for self-reliance and the sort of 7-year-old entry into primary school because you were part of the community and you learned the rules of the community before you went into formal education. Mm-hmm. I mean, so that was an attempt, to sort of, how successful was it?
No, it wasn't successful. I think it's because already there's been some contamination from the West. And I'm now or the view that it would probably be important for us to gather some zealous academics and get to find out what was there before that is important, that can be matched with that which is currently existing. Because I don't think we will get back to where we were. That is not possible. So at least just to get the best that was there before. Because it's the indications that what you've got now is not succeeding in any way in certain areas.
I suppose really it's the first post-colonial generation. I mean, all those early, Nyerere, etc. were products of the colonial administration.
Yeah.
Whereas now we're moving into sort of an area of Africanism, which the individuals haven't been sort of under the colonial.
But I think we've got to force that process of African Renaissance, where then we will probably be in a better position to say there's something that we can identify with that was important and that is even more relevant than what you've got now, which is exotic, because now there's been a replacement of what that which we had, that was more relevant, germane to the situation, been apt because it actually came from Africa.
I don't know if I can just answer that question, but is the young generation of, for example, Botswana, are they very interested in tradition and the knowledge from pre-colonialism?
Yeah, well, they are not, because they're Westerners, I'd say.
So they are U.S. influenced and so on in their search for identity and knowledge.
Yeah, but I think what's important is for us to package the knowledge and be able to relate very well to that which was there, to say this is what is was there, and to find out if they will be interested in that. Because we are saying to them, there is something that they've lost, but they don't know what that is. And that is where the problem is. So if we can overcome that, I think we will be better positioned than to give that which is more relevant and apt because it's African. But as I said, it's really an uphill struggle. It's going to be very difficult. It's a mammoth task. But you haven't just got to capitulate because it's difficult. I think we've got to make an attempt to get into doing it.
But Africa is a big continent. There must be different big differences between different countries.
Yes, but I think the initiative has to start somewhere. Of course, it's a diverse continent, but the way how it got colonized and then got westernized seemed to just give an indication that it can be transformed, which in that case would then mean it will be the differences that are there will be harmonized or can be harmonized. And I know it's going to take a long duration. It's going to take a lengthy duration. It's a process. And it has to be started somewhere. But I wouldn't say I promise that it would be achieved during my lifetime. Because but it has to be started. I mean, you've got to kickstart the process and leave it somewhere for posterity to continue.
There's a lot of work in this area in our center in Pretoria, with Catherine Adora Hoppers. I guess
who's
got a whole group of researchers looking at this area. So if you're not in touch with her, I can put you in touch with her.
Oh, thank you very much.
You are already.
Yeah.
I wanted to. Can I just ask one question? How do you see the Chinese influence increasing? You mentioned the fact now that Mandarin is being taught. There is a new generation of Chinese, Malaysian, Malaysian-run university in Haparoni.
Yes, yes.
There's a Malaysian-owned university, private university, in parallel, running different types of things in your city.
Yeah.
The Chinese are investing very heavily
in Africa, yes.
How do you see that progressing?
Oh, well, it's. I think we've got to, in a way, maybe get ourselves ready for it, be prepared for it, because there's a lot of infiltration now. Now it's no longer just the West, and the Chinese have also developed a lot of interest in investing in Africa. It then means we have even got to be more rigorous and have the enthusiasm to make sure that we get to unearth that knowledge that is lost, and even those approaches, so that we don't really get to kill them completely, because there is now this new development where the Chinese and other Asians are coming into the continent to invest. I see that as a new form of colonialism. And of course, also there is a talk about neo-colonialism. And I'd say this is maybe new than that which was new. That's really some form of colonialism. And from the experiences that we have had before, as we got colonized, I think we must have developed thick skin to really get to prevent that from getting us to the position where we were when we got colonized by the West. So we've got really to work into presenting our identity very strongly and making sure that the future generations don't actually fall in the same pitfall where we had the West coming in and injecting their influence and also their standards and concepts.
From the presentation, I have this
impression that what you are describing here and focusing on, that is really making a clear distance from traditional cultural geography, in the sense that you make field work and you make documentation and you make reports and you sort of save the tradition and you make it available in the shelf or on the internet. But the whole concept of orally transmission,
yeah,
knowledge,
yeah.
So that essential thing, the thing that ties generations together, that builds families and builds local communities. I mean, the internet is going to kill that anyhow, because any information in the world is available just 2 clicks away.
Yeah, but I think the internet is a vehicle that can be used to pass the same traditional information. I don't think it's the internet gives the information in any case. I think the information is actually put into that. So that would just be a vehicle to pass around that information. But firstly, we've got to work towards getting to establish what really transpired in the traditional schools, for instance, and be able to pass that or package it and then introduce it to... But I think it's even most important that there would be, that the process can be facilitated by the presence of that advanced technology through which we can then be able to package information and pass it around. But I know there's a danger of actually not getting back to what maybe happened during nativity, because some of it got lost since it wasn't documented. But I think we will just be working and getting that which we can still retrieve and forge ahead from there.
Just connecting to making your point, other places in the world have found their renewed their voice through the arts. You know, that seems to be to avoid that thing about going down into Western literacies. You know, and I think that I'm just thinking about Scotland and Ireland particularly, who I think have re-established some kind of strong identity again, but it's been through the arts, it's been through the oral traditions and things like that, rather than trying to sort of sell what was lost from the past, you know, through the education system. You know, I think it's been done that way. And Africa has such a rich it's got so much going for it in terms of dance, music, song, everything that can help to get those messages out, things from the past, revived again.
I think that can actually add value. That's a very good contribution. I think we can actually get to use some of the approaches I've said, mm-hmm. and also the technology. I don't think even if Africa wasn't colonized, it wouldn't have improved on what it had, because I think culture is not static. So in any case, there would still have been some changes. And also, there was a lot of movement of Africans in the continent, even if colonialism would have not come about, they wouldn't still have kept their the certain social settings. They wouldn't have clutched contumaciously to those particular cultures that existed, because of the interaction, because of exogamy, there were marriages between different ethnic groups. So that still would have, in a way, affected the kind of tradition that Africans had before. So I think we've got to find ways and means by which we can get to document that which we feel is lost. And that could make a good start.
We're condensing into one very short time period a little discussion about two projects that we're currently involved with, which are both funded by the European Commission, and they're both concerned with learning cities and learning regions. I'm going to just say something about this, a project which is called R3L Plus. Any of you who have previously been involved in this area of work would recognise what the acronym means, and if you haven't, it's completely mysterious. But it's regions of lifelong learning, hence the three, R3L. And the plus is because there was a big programme in the European, funded by the European Commission some years ago called R3L, which is a big network of 18 projects, which were all looking at the development of learning cities and learning regions in Europe. This project's called R3L Plus because we see it as an extension of some of that work. What it's really about is looking at models that exist of learning cities and learning regions, and I'll say something about what I mean by that in a moment, across Europe, and looking at, in particular, at mechanisms that have been put into place or not to develop quality systems within those initiatives, particularly in the context of adult education. This is typical of many European projects. These are the partners, and these are the places that we're using to develop case studies. Very conveniently, because we have so many Swedes here, we have a particular learning region in Lund. Here in Scotland, we're looking at the city of Dundee, which, if you don't know, is on the eastern coast of Scotland, a small city, I guess about 100,000 people, typical of the bleak east of Scotland. Learning regions. I guess most of you are familiar with this, but it's a concept which has sort of had its ups and downs. In the sense of, in many countries, and Lynette Moore might maybe say a little bit more about this in relation to the Eurolocal project, it's something that became very popular initially in the 1970s, promulgated by the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And it's been reinvented on a number of occasions, most particularly by the European Commission in the beginning of this decade. And there are many definitions. There's some aspects of that in that statement. But essentially you could say that it's the learning regions, learning cities are about ways in which you capitalize on the learning that exists across different stakeholders in the context of a particular, typically geographical area, looking at maximizing the role not only of the formal sector, but the non-formal sector as well. So it's about the things that go on in institutions like this, universities, colleges, schools, and so on, but also the contribution of the non-formal sector, whether it be museums, galleries, etc., the contribution of a whole range of stakeholders who might include the police, the health service, and so on, all of whom in certain ways are involved in learning, and finding ways in which you network those people more effectively for two purposes, essentially. One, to improve the economic conditions of that place, and a lot of the writing around learning regions is about the way in which you can make regions more attractive through clustering together a whole range of stakeholders to make the region attractive to those who might want to come into the region and invest for economic reasons. Equally, while the other main tendency in relation to learning region, learning city work is around social inclusivity, that by being much more overt about the contribution that's made by a variety of stakeholders, you'll find mechanisms that improve the flexibility of the system, therefore improve the ways in which access to that system could be achieved. And so that incorporates a lot of the things that you've been hearing about earlier today. You could say that lots of initiatives in the broad field of widening participation and access are do involve a range of stakeholders cooperating with each other. And in some other countries in the world, initiatives like, for example, developing a work-based learning program, initiatives which link the vocational education and training sector with the higher education sector, would be called a learning region initiative. It's all sometimes about the way in which you want to define things. The classic example being Germany. For those of you who don't know, Germany had a huge initiative. Something like 40 million euro was spent on developing learning regions. So every part of Germany, I can't remember how many in total, but 60, 70 learning region initiatives were created. When you actually look into those particular initiatives, they have one similarity in as much as they're trying to bring together different stakeholders to promote learning and access, but they have a lot of difference because each one could be about a very different thing. And so if you were in another place in the world, those things might not be called learning regions. So 2 points really. A lot of things which are learning regions in one place are not in others and are not defined that way. And a lot of things that we see in certain places in the world, we could actually define as being learning regions. So what this project is about though is looking at initiatives which could come under the broad definition of having the characteristics of a learning city or learning region, but are not necessarily defined as such, but finding such things which have the characteristics, and then looking at ways in which the quality of those initiatives are measured, and trying to find some generalizability around it and create ultimately a quality framework for cities and regions around these types of initiatives which link a variety of stakeholders together, whether it be for economic or whether it be for social purposes. Easy. In each of these countries that you've seen before, we're trying to choose a case. And so we work from a case to develop some principles that we can apply more generally to create a system for quality. Why Dundee? Well, those are the formal reasons, these interesting things that Dundee's doing. The reality, though, is it was the only one we could find. So if you look into the literature about learning cities and learning regions, you search on the net and you'll find huge amounts of funding that have gone into development of learning regions and learning cities in the UK. Glasgow was a learning city. Edinburgh was a learning city. Down in England, a whole range of different cities. Find one now? No, you won't. So that initiative, typical of many initiatives in many countries, had some government funding. People always are very happy to take government funding. They will then create an initiative. Government funding disappears. Initiative disappears. That's a little bit unfair because in some cities you can find evidence that things that were done under the label of being a learning city did get absorbed and continued, but with another name. But it's very, very difficult if you search through the UK now to find any initiative which calls itself a learning city initiative. Dundee is an example which does. All that being said, I imagine there are probably lots of things going on in other cities that don't call themselves learning cities, but which do have some of the characteristics. In terms of what we're doing in Dundee, we're looking at both the macro level, something called the Dundee Partnership, and the micro level, the community-based adult learning partnership. Now, the Dundee Partnership, you could say, fits into this overall model in Scotland where there is a statutory instrument within the Local Government in Scotland Act of 2003 that does make it a condition for regional authorities to be involved in community planning. And the Dundee Partnership, and this is, here we see the whole model, national level partnerships, regional partnerships, community planning partnerships, right down to the neighbourhood level, which do a variety of different things. Now, I think that's one important thing in relation to Scotland, that there is this statutory instrument in place, which makes it a necessity for local authorities to put in place systems that do network together a range of stakeholders across education, social services, environmental services, health services, fire brigade, and so on. They have to be linked together to have some joined up planning and strategic activity in relation to community planning. And that doesn't, I don't think it's true, I think from what people were saying this morning, that doesn't now exist in England, but Lynette will probably know better than I about that.
That's the Scottish system.
Well, people this morning were saying, well, there's nothing like that in England. And one thing that those of you who are not from the UK should listen out for the whole time. When people start saying UK, they mean England, if they're from England. They don't mean the UK. And they keep on doing it again and again. It's not like that in Wales. It's not like that in Scotland. We've got completely different legislative structures in most aspects of home affairs. So keep intervening and say, what, did you mean the UK? No, okay. So at one level there's a partnership. You see, the Dundee partnership. And this partnership pre-existed, but was found to be the perfect vehicle for implementing what was required by the legislative structure. And you see who's involved. All of these stakeholders, the police, the health services, voluntary groups, formal education sector, etc., etc. Now, community-based adult learning, you could say, is a subset of that. It's just one aspect of the implementation of community planning through adult education. So we have this. So what we're analysing is the partnership, which is the macro, and the micro, which is one particular implementation in one particular area. And when I wrote about this some years ago, when we did some analysis of learning region, learning city work, I realised when I was writing about this that we didn't call any of these types of partnerships which existed in Scotland because of the legislative structure. Nowhere was it called a learning city or learning region, but it fitted what the learning city and learning region was defined as, particularly by the European Commission and by others who write in this area. And what they've done in Dundee is retrospectively use the fact that they have got this macro level partnership and some of these micro level initiatives, relabeled it as being a learning city, because the learning city then becomes a very good and much sexier way of describing what they're doing. I won't go into all the details because Lynette needs to speak as well, but there is a full paper, and the full paper will give you a bit more detail about what happens in terms of the community-based adult learning, just as one subset of community planning. But and you will see the sorts of things that different stakeholders do in that context across a range of different activities, whether it be a department inside the region itself, a college, a VET college. I heard about VET, vocational education, they're called FE colleges here. One more traditional university and one more modern university, all making different contributions. And you could do that across a range. So these are the types of things that each stakeholder is contributing and which is being mapped across a range of dimensions. So you get the partners together and the partners start defining what they can do in relation to adult learning. They talk to each other and then you see where the synergies are, where the duplication is. Simple really, but not very frequently done. All this is also contextualised within something called a single outcome agreement, which is something an agreement between a range of stakeholders, which has been influenced by government policy. We've lost a few lines here. And there are various statements about from the Dundee partnership about the sorts of things that they will do and the commitments that they will make. And there are statements about achievements which give us the opportunity to be able to start measuring, defining and measuring quality indicators, because these are the sorts of things that they say within the partnership that they're achieving, which then gives you the opportunity then to create mechanisms whereby you can determine whether they're achieving those things. And that leads us towards developing a quality system. And basically the quality model that we're using really is based largely on the sort of work of people like Ron Farris, who wrote the Vancouver Learning City model. He talks about the 3P model: quality of partnerships, quality of participation within those partnerships, and issues of sustainability, of progress and renewal. And we then apply these characteristics towards these initiatives, and we're doing that in all the cases, in all of the countries, in order to come up with our quality model. And this is just one example of the types of things that we do. Look at some of the core quality criteria in partnerships, for example. You start defining these things and you can tick or give grades or whatever to those various characteristics. So you're then more systematically able to say, okay, you're a learning city. How well are you doing in terms of these characteristics like partnership or progression, etc. And so on. Participation, progress and sustainability. We're developing indicators for all of those things. So that's where that project is at the moment. We've got some next step, complete that quality matrix. We'll then apply that quality matrix in different countries in Europe. Then we're able to start defining some of the best practices in each of those areas, collate those and construct a model, develop a toolkit, disseminate. So that's what we're doing in that little project, which is R3L Plus. And I'll let Lynette come on board now to tell you a little bit about the other thing we're doing.
Oops.
Can you get out of that?
Thanks.
I'll get out of your way. That makes it easier. So we'll take some questions once Lynette has finished.
Yesterday I was kind of talking about the half of my work, which is the teaching bit of it in community development, but this is my research part of my remit in lifelong learning. Sorry, that was yesterday. Yeah, sorry about that. I'll just find where it is now. From the front, which one it is.
It's one called Face Slides down there.
No, that's the one I was in.
Uh-huh.
Face Slides. Oh, Unilocal Face. That's it, I've got it now. here we are. Thank goodness. Really sorry about that. this, as I say, is my research, and I work alongside Mike and another colleague, Robert Hamilton, on this piece of work. And this is a kind of sister project, R3L Plus, but it has a specific remit. It's all about gathering everything that we know about learning cities and learning regions and putting it into an interactive website so that people can both contribute, get knowledge, get ideas, get the learning materials that they can use. And of course, we want you to, you know, we want people to contribute as well. And we're just about to hopefully launch the website for people. But I'm going to tell you just a wee bit more about EuroLocal. So EuroLocal has slightly less partners. There are only four partners in this project, and we have one associate partner. But we've got us in Scotland. We've got the German partners who've university experience, as Mike said earlier, Hungary, and Italy. They just happen to all be involved in both. But the purpose and aims of it is it's about the European activities in the local and regional dimension of lifelong learning. And the project aims to help create and reinforce learning regions throughout Europe and expand people's vision to help a region achieve its potential. So all those who do not consider themselves to be learning regions and cities might, by seeing the amount of materials and the amount of data and things that have been collated over the years, might be inspired to begin to call themselves or see themselves as a learning city or a learning region. What we do on the site, and we're still doing it on a daily basis, we're trying to get as many of the things that we think would be useful to people so that they don't have to reinvent the wheel, so they can go into this site and say, I'd like to know something about such and such, you know, anything at all to do with learning cities and regions, and you'll get it on this site. By creating a sophisticated, interactive and dynamic web facility to store the information and to stimulate the feedback, by testing materials and tools in appropriate organisations, we've got each have specific area that we want to test these tools in to see if they're appropriate to that sector, and by marketing the learning region concept and the existence of the facility to all European regions. And we're going to top it at the end of the project by having a final seminar. I'm not going to talk about all this, I'm just going to tell you that there are 14 work packages or tasks that we have to do, and I've put in red the ones that you might be particularly interested in. The audits that we hope that people will contribute to, an innovative website which I've told you about, and contributing the data for the website, and maybe contributing and attending the final seminar. But we have to, over 2 years, make sure that we've done all this. All four partners have to contribute. So this is a site. What we will have for you under the knowledge base, different categories, various projects, organisations, resources, contacts. You might find that interesting to find out if there's somebody in your country, in your region, that is also doing some work, then you might be able to link up with them. So we will be able to allow you to see all these things. And we've quite considerable knowledge on the site by now. This is the bit that I'm blatantly flogging the seminar to you, because we do want people who are interested in this topic to come along to it. It's on 27th or 29th of October. Got some registration forms or information about the programme, draft programme at the moment, but nearly finalised. And if you are interested in coming along, you'd be very welcome. The whole idea is that, again, it will be interactive. We hope that you'll be able to contribute and share your knowledge. And it could be for anybody, regional developers, local authorities, academics, practitioners, whatever. And that's who you contact. There are other names or terms that people give themselves which are really similar to the learning city and region. Some people call themselves educating cities, creative cities, intelligent cities, and the learning cities. So sometimes they won't say a learning city, but they'll call themselves by other names. And this is a wee bit of the history, how it started. But if you want to see any of this, we'll put it on the website. You'll be able to access it. These were some of the examples in the UK, And Glasgow still considers it to be a hut. Does it? Yeah. If you talk to some of the key stakeholders at the time who developed it, like Stephen Young, who's usually from Scottish Enterprise, and they would say we are still, a planning city. And I think they believe it. I think quite rightly that they have those foundations, those ideas about learning being at the core of every other kind of development, is still to the fore.